All right, so we'll say good morning. Let's begin. Today's daf is Nun Aleph Amud Aleph. We are picking up 51. We are picking up from Nun Amud Beis 50b, five lines up from the bottom, the last word on the line. Hahu. We'll say, remember, we are in the middle of an interesting sugya of discussing the ability for daughters to be able to collect their mezonos from movable property. Everyone agrees that, of course, they could collect it from real property, from karka. Shaila is from the Talmud, are they able to collect their particular, their mezonos entitlement? So the Gemara tells a story. Hahud Asak made Rabbi Yosef. There was a girl who came before Rabbi Yosef, and again, she was asking for mezonos from her father's movable property. And what happened? Amar Luhu, Havu Lemi Tamri, the Abuja. So Rabbi Yosef said to whoever it was who was administering the father's estate, go ahead and give her from the dates the albuja. So Rabbi Yosef, so the albuja, Rashi says over here, Amachatzalo Shenosin Tachas Adikolim, Kishigojuna Tamarim. Remember again, how do you get dates off a palm tree? It's important to know. So you could do one of two things. You could shake the tree. Or often you see what they do is they take a stick, right? And they just hit the branches. And what they do is they put like a tarp on the bottom of the tree. And the dates all fall down over there. So Yosef said to the executor of the estate, give the girl from the dates that are on the mats underneath the tree. Amar le Abaye. Yeah, don't hit the dates. So Abai said to Rabbi Yosef, I don't understand. If let's say again, this wasn't the daughter asking for mezonos, but instead it was a creditor coming to collect a debt that was owed him by the father, would you have given this same advice? And I will say, a creditor is not permitted to go ahead and collect from movable property, from a tafelin. So why are you allowing the girl to collect from a tafelin in this particular case? So the Gemara says, So Rav Yosef qualified his statement and said, I didn't literally mean the dates that are on the mat underneath the tree, which are metatlin, rather what? I meant the dates that are on, still on the tree, but that are ready to be taken off the tree, are ready to come onto the mat. So meaning, they're still attached to the tree, which means what? They still have the din of karka, and that's why the girl has the right to go and collect them for mezonos, to which the Gemara says, so, but still at the end of the day, kala omeid ligzos ki gazos dami, but once we have a principle, that says that anything that is ready to be shorn or taken off is as if it's already been taken off. So the idea over here is since these dates are ready to come off the tree, they should have the status as if they're already off and therefore, again, be like metaltolin, to which the Gemara says, Ditzricha ledikla kaminar. So to which Rav Yosef responded, what I meant is to give her the dates that are still on the tree and still require the tree, i.e. to go ahead and give her her mezonos from karka. So what's like? So it comes out from this story is Rav Yosef was not allowing for collection of mezonos from a talmud, but rather he was only allowing for collection of mezonos from karka. In this case, again, the karka being the dates that were attached to the tree and still required and still needed to be attached to the tree. Hahu Yasom Yisoma the Asul Kamei Dirava. So that's another story. There was Yasom and Yisoma, an orphan boy and an orphan girl. They came before Rava. Amalu Rava, Ha'alu Liyasom Bishvil Yisoma. Go ahead and give extra food to the Asam for the Yisoma, for the girl. So we'll say, so I want just going backwards a little bit. This whole discussion gets off the ground, understand, because the notion of a daughter getting mezonos from her father's estate, halachically, is viewed as a balchol, right? It's viewed as she is like a creditor. So that's why this whole discussion is getting started over here, because if she's like a creditor, then by definition, she's treated like any other creditor, which means that she can only collect from real property. She cannot collect from any type of movable property. That's where this whole discussion, just so you understand the framework of it, as opposed to sons, what's the status of sons when their father dies? They're inheritors, right? It's Yerusha. So remember, it's a fundamentally different relationship. The girl is a creditor for the mezonos that's owed to her by the estate. The boy is an inheritor. So therefore, in this particular case, so you have a Yassam and Amana that came before Rava. I will say, in this case over here, Rashi points out that their property was in the hand of an apotropos, a hand of a trustee or an executor, someone's managing the estate. So they come before Rava for their mizonos. So give the boy some extra food for his sister. For his sister, Rava, Marhu Mimikarkoi Suva. But the Rabbanan said to Rava, but one second, Rabbi, you are the one who said that when it comes to mizonos, right? Sustenance for the girl, or for that matter for the woman, or for ksuva, or for parnasa. Also remember, parnasa means nidunya, parnasa means her dowry for her wedding. In all of these cases, these monies can only come from karka, from real property, and not from movable property. So if that's the case, why are you giving the mizonos to the girl from movable property of the estate? Amar Lahu, to which Rava responded, Ilu ratza shivcha l'shamsho milo yahavinale. If this boy came before us and said that he needed a housekeeper, right, he needed someone to help him out with domestic work, would we not have given him money for that? Kol shekin hacha di'iketarti. All the more so here in this particular case, where what? Where there are both of these aspects. I will say, now what does that mean? Rashi's both these aspects, di'iketarti, achoso, v'tishmashenu. So Rava felt in this particular case, apparently the nature of this family was the girl, the sister, was taking care of much of the domestic work. So therefore, Rava felt that because she was also, for number one, because she's a sister, and number two, because she was also fulfilling certain domestic responsibilities, therefore she should be entitled to mizonos from the estate. So we'll say again, remember, we're still not getting a totally clear answer about whether or not the Iker mizonos are permitted to come from the estate. If anything, from this particular story, it sounds like no, the halacha is mizonos cannot come. I'm sorry, not from the estate. Mizonos cannot come from metatlin. Mizonos only comes from karka. And the only reason why Rava awarded the girl mizonos from metatlin is because she was serving in a domestic capacity as well. And once it was his sister, plus serving in a domestic capacity, then halacha ma'aseh they gave her mizonos from the metatlin. Tan Rabbanan. So let's say another brayso. So echon nechasim sheish lamachrayus, ve'echon nechasim shein lanachrayus. So we'll say whether you have property. Now, understand, nechasim sheish lanachrayus means land. Now, the reason why we call that nechasim sheish lanachrayus, because what that means is, if normally when I sell land to someone, I sell that with achrayus. Achrayus means, let's say I sell Reuven land. So when I sell that land, what I'm telling Reuven is, look, should the land that I sold you be seized by any of my creditors, come back to me and I will make you whole. That's what it means in the chasim sheyesh lahen achrayus. As opposed to when you sell movable property, no such guarantee comes along with that. So whether you have the chasim sheyesh lahen achrayus land, ve'echa the chasim sheyesh lahen achrayus metal the movable property, motzien lemazon isham ulabanos divrei Rebbe. So we'll say Rebbe says that you can go ahead and even use movable property or real property for mazon isha ulabanos to go ahead and sustain a wife or daughters after death of husband, father. So these words of Rebbe. Rebbe Shimon Elazar, Rebbe Shimon Elazar says, nope. Nechasim sheish lanachrayis motzi in labanos minat. So listen to this. So Rebbe Shimon Elazar says like this. Nechasim sheish lanachrayis, when it comes to land, real property, so motziin labanos min habanim. We will extract it from the sons for the daughters. Rebbe say, now what that means over here is, let's say father dies, and sons inherit. We will extract property from the sons for mazon and parnasa, for sustenance of the girls, and ultimately again for their dowry. Next, so motzien labanos min habanim, ulabanos min habanos. Let's say the father only had girls and he died. So let's say some of the older girls seized all of the property. We will extract the rightful share of the younger girls from the older girls and give it to them. Ulabanim min habanim. Similarly, let's say you have a family of sons, and the older sons seized all of the property, we will extract the property from the older ones to properly distribute it to the younger ones as well. Ulebanim min abanos. Let's say you have a family with assertive women, and what happened? Again, you have sons and daughters, and what happened? The father died, and the girls seized the property. We will go ahead and extract it from the girls, and go ahead and give it to the boys. Ulebanos min abanim. Ulebanim min abanos, excuse me. All of this is said when there's a lot of property. But I will say, if you have the following situation, let's say the father had very little property, and when the father died, the girls seized it. And I will say, there's only enough property to be able to give the girls mezonos, but nothing else. In that case, we will allow the girls to go ahead and hold on to that property, and we will not extract it for the boys' yushavos. Now, that is part of a general principle that whenever there is limited assets within an estate, the first thing we take care of is mezonos for the girls. That's the first thing we take care of. If there's anything left afterwards, then we can talk about Yerusha. But if there's nothing, but I mean, if there's only limited left and only for mezonos for the girls, the Gemara says the boys, yachzra lapsachim, let them go out and beg, but we take care of the needs of the girls first. So in that case, where let's say there was only a small amount of property and the girls seized it after the death of their father, we would not extract it from them to go ahead and give it to the boys. We'll say if you have movable property, motzin labanim min habanos. So I will say this is now metaltolin. So metaltolin, excuse me, motzin labanim min habanim. I'm sorry. So if you have movable property, and let's say that father died and some of the sons seized it, you would extract it from some of the sons in order to properly distribute it to all of the sons. Ulabanos min habanos. Both say same thing. If you have a family of only girls and some of the older girls seize the property, you would extract it from them in order to give it and share it with all of the girls. Ulebanim min habanos. Similarly, both say if the girls seized it, you would extract it from them to give it as the Yerusha for the boys. However, avalo lebanos min habanim. But Jabal say, what won't you do? You will not go ahead and extract it from the boys for the girls. Well, that was a very long way of teaching us that what? That girls do not have a share in nechasim she'ein lahan achrayus. They do not have a share in metaltolin. Forget about by Yerusha, because if they're boys, they don't get Yerusha. But even by mizonos, right? That even when it comes to as much as they have a lien against for mizonos against the estate, that lien only devolves on karka, on real property, but not on movable property, not on what we call nechasim she'ein lahan achrayus. So I will say this is the fundamental machlokus between Rebbe and Rebbe Shimon HaLazar. So Rebbe holds that lemaisa, the lien or the obligation of mezonos, really is extracted either from real or movable property. And Rebbe Shimon HaLazar says no, it's only from real property, but not from movable property. So look how the Gemara ends. Even though normally we still will say that whenever Rebbe has a machlokus with someone, the halacha always follows Rebbe. It's a general, what we call klali hora. One of the rules of passing halacha is we follow Rebbe. Nevertheless, hacha, halacha k'Rebbe Shimon HaLazar. Here, the halacha is that we follow Rebbe Shimon HaLazar. That's what? That you can't extract mezonos from movable property. Do amar Rava, hilcha sami mekarkoi, v'lova metaltali, bein l'ksuva, bein l'mezone, bein l'parnasa. Because the say Rava said, the halacha is that we only go ahead and satisfy the ksuva, mizonos, and parnasa dowry from karka and not from movable property. So we'll say, how do we act now? Sounds like the Gemara ends up with a pretty resolute psak halacha. But what is the halacha? And we'll say, it's actually exceptionally important because lemaisa, again, you can have a father that dies and a girl that still has, girls that still have financial claims against the estate for mizonos, for parnasa, for dowry, a wife for ksuva. So how do we pay? Listen to this. So the Shulchan Aruch is in Evan HaEzer. Hilchos ksuvos simen kuf sit aleph writes medina de gemara ksuva the hainu ikr ksuva v'tosefes eina nigavim ela min akarka. So we'll say the halacha is, this is what the gemara just quoted, medina de gemara, according to the basic letter of the law of the gemara, so ksuva and every part of it, ksuva tosefes, ksuva means the ikr ksuva, tosefes means any additional monies, are only collectible from karka. Umitakonas hageonim, but I will say there is a takonas hageonim that says nigavim af mina metaltolin. They can even be collected from movable property. Vuadin lechol tana'eha, and this is true for all of the conditions of the ksuba as well. Chutz miksubas benin dichrin. We actually saw this exception, right? This exception ultimately was the ksubas benin dichrin. Remember, is the clause in the ksuba where a woman says to her husband, or that it's written that my sons that you and I have together shall inherit my ksuba. So if you have other sons, they can inherit the rest of your estate. My sons also get a share of the rest of your estate, but my sons specifically get my ksuba. So we'll say that clause only applies if there's real property, doesn't apply to movable property at all. So therefore, again, halach lemaisa, what the Shulchan Aruch is saying, and again, there's much more. I'll just tell you, it's interesting. Yeah, it's va'achshav noagim lichtov b'chol ha'ksuvos. ששיבד לה כל נכסיו מקרקעי ומטלטלי 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 אגב מקרקעי דקנאי ודקאקנא. The Bible says, now that's why today, interesting, when we write a ksuva, so our ksuva reflects the takanas gaonim, reflects the fact that today a husband willingly is mishabed, puts a lien against all of his property, both real and movable, for the ksuva. We'll say, where do we say this in the ksuva? We say this in the ksuva, va'afilu min galima da'al kasboi. Remember, I say that all of my property is encumbered, and even the shirt on my back. Now, the shirt on my back is representative of all of my movable property. Not only that, but what he points out over here is that ksuva has a ridiculous lien that we don't find anywhere else, because it's on what I own and what I will ever own. We don't find a lien like that anywhere else in halacha, because normally a lien is only devolves upon that which you have at the time of the transaction. But the notion that a lien will cover anything that I don't even know what I'm going to own, but whatever it is going to be encumbered, that's pretty much ksuva. So we'll see an interesting distinction over here between the dina de gemara. So dina de gemara is that ksuva only creates a lien against real property, takanas geonim, that ultimately the lien is against everything, even against metalkalin. And we'll say similarly, listen to this. He writes, Akshav Shaksuva Nigvis Avil Metalkalin. So the Shulchan Aruch goes on, this is a different simon. This is in simon Kof Yod Beis. So he writes that now that we've established that ksuva is collected from everything, even from metalkalin, Gam Habanos Nizonos Mehem. So too, again, Mizonos also comes from anything as well. Ve'enam Nizonos Alev Mechari Avalom Mishwadir. We'll say with one caveat. One caveat is that girls cannot go ahead and seize sold properties in satisfaction of their mezonos. So even though they're like a creditor, they don't have the ability to go and seize property that was previously sold by their father during his lifetime to satisfy their mezonos obligations. So also what comes out, halacha lemaisa, is that although we pass on like Rabbi Shimon, maker adin, that ksuva and mezonos can only come from real property, nevertheless the takanas geonim makes the halacha like Rebbe. Right, Takanas Geonim says that you could collect everything ksuva, mizonos, parnasa, even from metalkalim. Good, says the Mishnah. Lo kasav la ksuva. Well, it's an interesting case. A man did not write a ksuva for his wife. Didn't write a ksuva. So what's the halacha? Besula gova masayim. A besula still collects 200 zuz. Va'almana mana. And an almana collects 100 zuz. Why? Mipnei shi tanai beizin. Because they both say, since ksuva is an enactment of beizin, therefore what? Therefore, even if I don't write the document, the obligation is still there upon me. Similarly, again, if he writes her, let's say he puts a lien against the field that is worth 100 zuz, tachas masayim zuz, but again, the ksuva is worth 200. Below kasav la kol nechasim dislan achrayim l'ksuva seich, chayiv shutanai beizin. Similarly, let's say a man goes in and writes in the wife's ksuva, I hereby set aside, write field A as your ksuva, as your future ksuva payment. There's only one problem. Field A is only worth 100 zuz. So he didn't. Now, normally what you would do is you would write in a supplemental phrase that would say what? And therefore, again, the rest of my property is encumbered for the remaining value of the ksuba. Even if he didn't write that phrase, nevertheless, what? His property is encumbered. Why? Because it was like ksuba's tanai basis. What's what the Mishnah is coming to really show us over here is really, even if he wrote nothing, at the end of the day, your property, really your life, is encumbered by the ksuva. So ultimately, again, so that's why that's the idea of a tanai beizin creates a reality that's there, even if you don't actually commit it to writing. So the Gemara says, lo kasav la im, so listen to this, lo kasav la im tishtaboy afarkinach va'osivnach li intu. Now, normally what is actually interesting, what they used to also write in the ksuva is this phrase, if you are captured, I agree to redeem you. Can you imagine reading this under the chuppah? Right. If you are captured, I agree to redeem you and to restore you as my wife. Now, I'll say, now the idea over here, I'm sorry?
Probably not.
Yeah, it's in Aramaic. Right? So understand over here that what this is saying is two things. Number one, if she's taken captive, I will redeem her. I'll say the second part is also very important. And I agree to remain married to you. Now, both say, now the need for that phrase is because even though the assumption is, like we've spent a lot of time discussing, that a woman is violated by her captors, the husband says, I still agree to maintain you as my wife, even after such an event occurs. So I'll say, even if he doesn't write this, chayiv, you still have to redeem her. Even if you don't write in the ksuba, He still has to redeem her from the captives. Why? Again, same idea, Shehu Tanai Beis Din. Because once at the end of the day, this is a Tanai of Beis Din. And therefore, you see the theme already, that if something is a Tanai of Beis Din, whether you write it or not, it's immaterial. The Tanai is upon you. Nishbis, Silabo say, if she is taken captive, Chayiv Lefdosa, you're obligated to go ahead and redeem her. V'im Amar, Hagita Uksuvasa, V'tipada Es Atzma. So we'll say it's a real romantic here. So what happens? So the guy goes in and he says, my wife is taken captive. He says, look, here's your get. Here's your ksuva, meaning here's your money. Here's your money. You know, hatzlacha rabba, right? Why don't you take care of it yourself? So the halacha is eino rashai. He is not permitted to do this. Also, because remember, at the moment that he marries her, that's when the obligation to redeem her really sets in upon him. Therefore, he is not permitted to shirk that responsibility now by divorcing her and paying out her ksuva. Also, I mean, what he's trying to essentially say is, look, it's not my problem. It's not my problem, you know, because you're not my wife anymore. And therefore, I'm leaving you sufficient money. I'm leaving you a lot of money. Go take care of it yourself. You can't do that. On the other hand, Loksa, let's say again, Chas Hashem, she was stricken with illness. So what happens? He is obligated to do whatever he can to heal her, which also, of course, doesn't mean that he's obligated to become a doctor, but he is obligated to get her help. Amar Hare Gita Uksuvasa Tirpas Atzma. Let's say he says, you know what? I'm not really interested in this. Here is your get. Here is your ksuva, and please seek out the medical attention on your own. So the Mishnah says, Rashoi, she is he is permitted to do that. Now, we will see this distinction ultimately again in the Gemara. Says the Gemara, money, whose opinion does our Mishnah reflect? Rabbi Meir is of the opinion that if you go ahead and you try to make a ksuva for a besula less than 200 or for a mana less than 100, it's like bi'ilazus. Now, I'm also saying it's bi'ilazus is another way of saying it doesn't work. Meaning, Rabbi Meir says you cannot diminish the amount of ksuva. Meaning, 200 zuz for a besula, 100 zuz for an amana, that is the standard amount, and you cannot diminish it. And even if you try, the halacha prevents you from doing so by what? By going ahead and establishing that amount as a tanai beis din. On the other hand, di Rabbi Yehuda, because if it was Rabbi Yehuda, meaning if our Mishnah referred to the view of Rabbi Yehuda, Ha'amar ratza kosev lebesula shtar shamasayim, v'hi kosevis hiskabati mimcha mana, ula amana mana, v'hi kosevis hiskabati mimcha chamishim zuz. Because most Rabbi Yehuda says there is a way to diminish a ksuva. How do you diminish a ksuva? So you go ahead and you have the wife, you go ahead and you write a shtar for masayim, so you're marrying a besula. So you write her a shtar for 200 zuz, and she writes a receipt that I have received 100. And I will say, now obviously she hasn't received anything, but what does that receipt essentially represent? That she's being mochel, that she is giving up her right to 100 zuz. So Yehuda holds that a woman absolutely has the right to be mocheles on some part of her ksuba. So I will say, fundamental machlokes, Rabbi Meir says a woman doesn't even have the right to be mocheles on her ksuba, because ksuba is a tanai beis din. So whether the woman is mochel, it's irrelevant. Husband doesn't write it, it's irrelevant. That 200 zuz obligation stands. Rabbi Yehuda says, no, a woman can absolutely be mochelas by essentially writing a receipt that she has received part of the payment. That's her form of being mochel. I but ema seifa. So we'll say, therefore, the Mishnah seems to reflect the view of Rabbi Meir, because the Mishnah clearly indicates that what? That you can't tamper with the ksuba amount. It is what it is. On the other hand, ema seifa. Look at the end of the Mishnah. Kasav vasadeh shaveh maneh. If he went ahead and he wrote her in the ksuba for a sada that is worth a maneh, Tachas Masayim Zuz, below Kasav La, Kol Nechasim, the Isli Achron, the Ksuva Seich. Also, on the other hand, what did the Seif of the Mishnah say? That if he wrote for her for a Ksuva, a field that was worth 100 Zuz, 100, and what happened? And instead of 200, and you did not write, include any supplemental phrase in the Ksuva itself that indicated that you were being Meshavi the rest of your property for the remainder of the Ksuva, Chayiv, you are Chayiv, why? Shud Tanai Beis Din, because it was like Ksuva is Tanai Beis Din. So, Asan Rabbi Yehuda, this seems to reflect the view of Rabbi Yehuda, who says what? The Amar Achrayes Taos Soferu. What is interesting? Rabbi Yehuda holds that in general, whenever you're dealing with certain obligations, so obligations come with Achrayes, responsibility of the person who is the making the deal to guarantee the deal. And if Achrayes is missing from the shtar, we call that a Taos Sofer. It's called a mistake. So for example, on both sides, if I'm selling property to Reuven, normally what I would write in the shtar is Reuven, if for some reason the property that I'm selling you is seized by one of my creditors in satisfaction of a pre-existing debt, You'll come to me and I will go ahead and make you whole. Let's say you didn't write that in the Shtar. So Rabbi Huda holds that we assume that that responsibility is there, but it's what's called a Tov Sofer. It's a mistake. So he, Rabbi Huda, holds that anytime you omit Achrayus, we don't look at that as if he's not taking responsibility, because that's not possible. Rather, we look at it simply as a scribal omission. So the Gemara says, "De'i Rabbi Meir ha'amar Achrayus la Tov Sofer," because we're also claiming to Rabbi Meir holds that no, if Achrayus is missing from the shtar. Well, say that's not called the Ta'o Sofer. What is that called? What is that called? That's called a willful omission, right? That's called ultimately at the end of the day, they chose not to include Achrayus as part of this transaction. This none of us listen to this because we learned Matzah Shtaricho. If you find, excuse me, Matzah Shtaricho, if you find, let's say, loan documents, Yesh Ban Achrayus, the Chasim. Well, say if the documents themselves have the Achrayus and the Chasim. Well, say, in other words, that ultimately, if the borrower went ahead and was meshaved his property, he encumbered his property for the debt, then what's the halacha? Lo yachzir, you may not return the documents. Shebeis din nifraim hen, because Rabosai, these are documents that are technically collectible. Rabosai, now what are we concerned about over here? We're concerned about it like this. We're concerned that perhaps the borrower was already paid back. But now what's going on? There's some collusion again with the lender. What's the collusion? That the borrower is going to plead poverty. He has absolutely no money. The lender is going to go out and therefore be entitled to what? Be entitled to seize properties that the borrower sold prior to the date, or after the date, I should say, of the transaction. And they're in collusion with each other. Therefore, if you find a document that has achrayus nechassim in it and it's lost, you cannot return that because we're concerned that that may allow the borrower and the lender together to potentially defraud one of the purchasers of land. On the other hand, ein ban achrayis, if the property, if the shtar does not have achrayis nechasim, then yachzir shein bezin nifrayim mehen, then you could return it because the truth is it's not such a big deal. Oh, the worst that could happen is that the lender could go out and potentially collect a second time from the credit from the borrower himself. But there's no fear of being able to defraud anyone else. Did Rabbi Meir? These words are the Chum say no, Echazeva Echazelo. The Chum, on the other hand, say no, that's what? Either one, whether it states Achrayis Nechassim or doesn't state Achrayis Nechassim, you should not return this document. Why? Because it was the Chachamim say that whether Achrayis Nechassim is stated or not, it's understood to be part of the transaction. So what do you see? The Gemara says, so Reish Rabbi Meir, the Sefer Rabbi Huda. Therefore, what it looks like over here is that the Reisha, the beginning of this Mishnah, is Rabbi Meir, and the Seifa is Rabbi Yehuda. So, because remember again, now we have competing values. Because on one hand, what we're saying is the beginning of the Mishnah is teaching us that what? That Lamaisa, even if you don't write 200 zuz, it's still what? You're still on the hook for 200 zuz because it's Tanai Basin. So, we'll say that reflects the view of Rabbi Meir. Okay? But yet, the Seifa of the Mishnah says that if you omit Achrayas Nechasim, if you forget to write in the shtar that all of your property is encumbered by the ksuva debt, we assume that that achrayas exists even if you did not write it in the shtar. Whose opinion does that reflect? Both say that's Rabbi Yehuda. Because according to Rabbi Meir, if you omit achrayas nechassan in the shtar, we assume that what? That was a willful omission, and therefore there is no achrayas. So this is just a strange setup. Remember, when it comes to Mishnaic setup, we normally like to have one opinion throughout the Mishnah, unless, of course, a second opinion is explicitly stated in the Mishnah. The way it's set up now is that the Reisha is Rabbi Meir, the first case reflects Rabbi Meir, and the Sefer reflects Rabbi Huda. Or maybe you'll say, no, the entire Mishnah is Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Meir, Ben Kisuva L'shtari. And maybe Rabbi Osai, like this, maybe even Rabbi Meir agrees that when it comes to Kisuva, so omission of Achrayas Nechasim is meaningless. Because we assume that there is a chrayas nechassim even if it's not explicitly stated. And when did Rabbi Meir say that the omission of a chrayas nechassim means that there is no chrayas nechassim? When is that? That's by other shtaros, by other transactions. And therefore, again, even Rabbi Meir would agree that if you don't write a chrayas nechassim in a ksuva, it's still there. So which the answer is only shinily, but is that true? Tanya, we learned chamisha gov min amichurarin. Say there are five people that can only go ahead and collect from what we call nechassim b'nei chorin. So, nechassim and nechorin is property that is owned by the debtor. It's property that is owned by the debtor. So, there are five situations where you can only go ahead and collect from the chasim from the chasim and or an unencumbered or really owned property. Again, property that is owned right now by the person who owes the money, the debtor. These are the five cases. Peros, v'shevach peros. So this is actually an interesting case. This is a case over here where let's say Reuven stole a field, and he sold me the field. He sold me the field, and I went ahead, and now remember when he sold it to me, he said to me, "Look, there's a achrayus. If anything happens, I'll pay you back for the land. Don't worry." So in the meantime, I go ahead and I till the soil, I fertilize, I plant, and I even have some crops that grew. What happens now? The rightful owner of the field comes and takes the field back from me. So I go back to Reuven and I say, "Reuven, listen, you need to make me on the bus." And I have two claims against Reuven, right? What are the two claims? Claim number one is for the keren, for the basic principle for the land. Claims number two is potentially two and three is shevach peros, meaning I've been any land improvements or actual produce. So I say it's chilek for the keren, for the land itself. I have the ability to even go after nechassim meshuvadim. I have the ability even to go after property that Reuven sold after the time that he sold me my land, because those lands are encumbered to me. But for peros and shevach peros, for actual produce or land improvements, that I cannot collect that from land that Reuven sold. I can only collect that from what we call nechassim benecholim, property that Reuven himself owns. Similarly, if one accepts upon himself to support his wife's son and his or his wife's daughter, this case I will say also can only this. Let's say now they come to the estate with monies owed, so that can only be collected again from the chasim b'nei and not from the chasim mishubadim. The get chov and another get chov I will say is another debt she'in ba'achrayis that has no achrayis written into it. Similarly, Rabbi saying, if you have a ksuva that also doesn't have achrayis written into it, in these cases, you can only collect from the chasim benichor, not from the chasim mishubadim. Rabbi saying, so what do you see from here? What do you see from here? You see from here that Rabbi Meir holds. I'm sorry. Manch, let's finish the argument. Manch shamis la the amar achrayis lav tal sofer who will say, who is the one who said to us that the omission of achrayis is not considered to be a scribal error? Rabbi Meir, it's Rabbi Meir, and yet the katani ksuvas isha. And I will say, yeah, what do you see? You see that Rabbi Meir holds that even the omission of achrayas from a ksuva is still considered to be a valid omission. Therefore, I will say we're kind of back to square one, meaning that the end of the Mishnah can't be Rabbi Meir, because you wanted to suggest that the sefer of the Mishnah could even be Rabbi Meir, because even Rabbi Meir, who normally says that omission of achrayas is not a ta'os sofer, will agree that in the case of ksuva, it is a ta'os sofer. But what do you see from here? Seeing that Rabbi Meir holds that even by a ksuva, omission of achrayis means that there is no acceptance of achrayis. So, also, just you should know, the common denominator, by the way, in all of the cases that was mentioned in the Braisa above, of the peros, shevach peros, mekabel avlozon es ben ishto, so often these are situations where the amount is undefined. Because the amount is undefined, it would be unfair to place a lien, an undefined lien, against property that the debtor would ultimately sell, because again, I will say undefined liens are very difficult to impose upon sold property. You can impose them upon the chasim b'nechorin, right? Property that the debtor currently owns, but not upon sold property. So iba yisema. Second, so iba yisema. Rabbi Meir, the yisema Rabbi Huda. So we'll say now we're going to try to resolve this. So one possibility is no, it is really Rabbi Meir. The other possibility is it is Rabbi Huda. So what's the case? So iba yisema Rabbi Huda. I'm sorry. Iba yisema Rabbi Huda. Different says Rabbi Huda Hassam in the Mishnah. I was saying, I remember there are two Mishnahs we're dealing with over here. There's the Mishnah that the Gemara is quoting over here from Nundalit Amud Beis. From Nundalit Amud Beis. So that Mishnah, that's the Mishnah of Kalapoches Mibsula Mimasayim Ula Amana Mimana Hare Zubi Ilas Znos. So that is the first white line in the Gemara. So whoever goes ahead and diminishes the ksuba of a besula from 200, for an amana from 100, so it doesn't work. That's one Mishnah. And of course, the other Mishnah is the Mishnah we just read. So the Gemara is trying to say this. Hasam, in the Mishnah that was quoted in the Gemara, kasvala hiskabli, hachalo kasvala hiskabli. So we'll say, very simple, Rabbi Huda will say, that in the case of the Mishnah, is where ultimately, he wrote her hiskabli, she wrote to him hiskabalti, I'm sorry. In the case of the Mishnah, Anundalid, that's where she wrote to him, I already received 100 zuz. So we'll say if she wrote him, I received 100 zuz, then what? She has the right to go ahead and forgive some part of the ksuba. But if she doesn't forgive any part of the ksuba, then what is the halacha Rabbo say? The 200 zuz stands, even if he tries to diminish it. Eva, you see, the second possibility is Rabbi Meir, and really it follows the view of Rabbi Meir. And my chayiv diktanim, mina mechurarin, and maybe it is Rabbi Meir. And what does it mean when it says that he is chayiv? It means he is chayiv from what Rabbi say, chayiv from the chasim b'nei chorin. That when Rabbi Meir writes in the Mishnah, that even if he didn't write 200 zuz, he is still chayiv for 200 zuz. What does it mean, chayiv? Chayiv not from the chasim b'nei, from the chasim b'shubadim, but only from the chasim b'nei chorin, only from property that he currently owns, in conformance with the view of Rabbi Meir, that what? That lamaisa, omission of achrayas from a shtar is not ta'os sofer. Therefore, in this case, there's no achrayas, so he still owes the money, but the money only will come from the chasim b'nei chorin. Fine. Lo ka'as of law. Amar avu adi Shmuel. There was another interesting case. Ishis Yisrael shenensa. If the wife of a Yisrael was violated, asur l'bayla. It was that she is asur to her husband. Why? Chayshinan shema tchilasa ba'onis sisofa barasom. We are concerned that perhaps when she was violated, as much as the beginning was against her will, perhaps again by the end of the act, she was compliant, it was willful, and therefore again she's prohibited to her husband. Okay. Eisve Rav la'avu ad Shmuel. So Rav said, so Rav brings the kasha to the father of Shmuel. Im tishtaboi af rekinach va'osiv nach li le'intu. How can you say that? Right? Meaning it's written in the ksuba. What does the clause say? If you're taken captive, I will redeem you and I will restore you as my wife. Now, as you said before, restoring you as my wife means that I recognize, husband saying, I recognize that you may be violated in your captivity, but I still agree to remain married to you. But Javosa indicates to us what? That a woman who's violating captivity is permitted to her husband. So Ishtik, so Avu Dishmol was silent. He didn't have a retort to this. Kari Rav Ali Davod Shmuel. So Rav said about the father of Shmuel, Sarim Asru Mamilim, right? The great officers or the great ministers were at a loss for words. The Kaf Yasimu Lupihan. They put their hand over their mouth. In other words, they were literally at a loss for words. My Islay the Mimar, what should Shmuel have? What should Avuad Shmuel, what should the father of Shmuel have said? Bishvuy Hakilu, he should have said, well, no, the case of when a woman is taken captive, that's different. They're makel by Shvuya. They're makel by Shvuya. So also remember, Avuad Shmuel made his statement not by Shvuya. He made his case by Stam woman who was violated. He said that's where you have to be concerned with maybe what we call Tchilasa Ba'ones. The beginning was against throw of a sof baratzon. Maybe by the end it was baratzon. But again, but the case of the Mishnah is talking about a case of Shvuya. So it could be by Shvuya that ultimately again we are lenient. And therefore we don't assume, or I should say, we're just more makel. And therefore, even although she was violated, we allow her to be returned to her husband. And here's the problem. Torah speaks about a case of a woman who's violated. And Torah indicates that Lamaisa, she's permitted to her husband. Avuah d'Shmuel is saying we have to be concerned that if she was violated, that perhaps even though the beginning was against her will, perhaps by the end she was compliant and she was willful. And therefore, she's permitted to her husband. If that's the case, then how do you ever have a case of a woman who's violated, who's permitted to her husband? So where there were Edim that say that she fought her attacker from the beginning till the end, meaning that it was clear from her actions that she did not want this act. Upligi de Rava, and this argues on Rava, because Rava says, Kol shet tchilasa ba'oneis v'sof beratzav, because Rava says, any case, if a woman was violated, and the beginning was onis, even if you want to say the end was ratzon. Now listen to this. Afilu hi omeres, hanichulo. Even if when people try to remove the attacker, she says, no, leave him alone. She'omale lo niskak la, hisoch rasa. I will say, now again, literally, what she's saying over here is that even if he wouldn't have done this to me, I would have hired him to do this to me. In other words, I will say, if it appears that she is now willful in the act, nevertheless, muteres. She is still permitted to her husband. Why? My taima yetzer al bisha. Because the say it is possible that although the beginning of the act began with the violation of the woman, it's possible again that she enjoys the act once it began. And therefore, even if she said, don't, obviously this is an exaggerated case, we're trying to make a point. Even if she said, don't remove the attacker, we still consider it to be against her will. And ultimately, she's putting it to us. And others will say, what Rava's essentially saying is, all we do is we look at how the act occurred. If the act was against your will, it makes absolutely no difference what happened during or after the act. What matters is that the initiation of this act was an attack by the woman, attack on the woman. That's all that matters to us. We don't care about the rest of it. We only care about the beginning. Tanya Kavase de Rava, there's an opinion, or Bryce that supports Rava, the Hilonis Pasuk. Remember, the Pasuk says, she was not forced. Rava said, this is talking about, again, a situation where a woman has relations with a man, and she was not coerced by the man. So astalocha asura. So in that case, again, Rava says, she'll become asur. Hanis pasa muteres. But obviously, if she was violated against her will, she remains permitted to her husband. And there's another case of a woman where even though she was not forced, she still remains permitted to her husband. The Ezo Zu, and what case is this? Even our both, like the beginning was honest, the beginning was against her will, even if over the course of the act she became a willful participant, she is still permitted to her husband since it was Tchilasa Ba'onis, since the beginning of it was an act of violation. Tanya Idach, another Braisa. She was not forced. Asura. She is asura to her husband. Hanispas. We see from here that if she was forced, muteres. She is permitted. Asura. But there is another case where even though she was forced, she'll still be asura. Ve'ezo. Who is that? Zu'eshes coin. Abbas says, first the wife of a coin. That if the wife of a coin is violated, even though it's against her will, at the end of the day, she is still permitted to her husband. Just more drushes. She was not forced. Asura, harness pasa muteres. But we see that if she was forced, she'd be mutter. There's another case of a woman who, even though it was not done to her against her will, she will still be muteres. So what's the case? The ezozu. What's that case? There was a woman who was betrothed now with what we call kiddush etos. So therefore, it turns out that retroactively, what? She was not married. And therefore, again, Lamaisa, even if the quote-unquote violation, even if she had relations with another man willfully, it still won't make her asura to her husband. Why? Because it turns out she wasn't married. And therefore, again, she essentially had relations with another man. But technically, if she wanted to now remarry this man, she'd be permitted to do so. Because in a case like this, that even if literally she had a child with this man, if it's Kiddushei Tos, all she needs to do is refuse the marriage, and she gets out of it. I'm Rabbi Yehuda. Honey, nashi diganvi, diganvu ganvi shayin legavayu. Both said these women who were stolen from their husbands, they were taken by their husbands by thieves, are permitted to go back to their husbands once they are released. Amrli rabbanan Rabbi Yehuda v'ha kamatinan luhu nama. But I both said, but we've observed these women and they're bringing bread to their captors, meaning they're serving like in a wifely domestic capacity. So it sounds like they're willfully there. So how can you let them go back to their husbands? No. Mach masira. Yeah, they're doing it, but what they're doing is they're doing it out of fear. V'ha kamashal kalu giri. But yet, when these thieves who take them captive, go out to battle, they're handing them arrows. Again, mach masira. This is done ultimately out of fear. Obviously, v'adai shavakinu v'azlan minafshayu asiran. Rabbosai goes without saying that what? It goes without saying that lemaisa, if these thieves would allow the women to go free, but they still remain willingly with their captor husbands, then obviously in such a situation that indicates that Lamaisa, again, they are there willingly, and at that point in time, they would become asuros to their husbands. Plus, we have to stop. We're not finished with this, but we'll stop. We'll pick up with the Tanur Rabbanan and Ner Tishan tomorrow.